welcome to Ariel Helwani's MMA Show!
Hello again, everyone. I'm Ariel Helwani. That is Mark Raimondi. That is Brett Okamoto. We are here in Las Vegas counting down the days till the end of the decade. Yes, the decade is coming to an end, and we have no live show today, but we've got a very special treat for all of you. On today's program, we are going to talk about the stories that define the past 10 years in mixed martial arts. And I'm sure you know this, a lot has happened over the past 10 years. Probably more things happen in these past 10 years than in the previous 16 or so years in the history of this great sport. And I thought it would be fun, just off the bat, guys, to actually look back at a story ESPN.com did 10 years ago, almost exactly 10 years ago to the date, where they talked about the top 10 stories of the past 10 years, essentially 2000 to 2009. These are the top 10, just to give you some context as to, you know, where the decade started, so to speak. Number 10 was the New Year's Eve wars in Japan. Not really a factor anymore. Number 9, Gina Carano. Number 8, the death of Evan Tanner. Number 7, Lee Murray. Number 6, the irony of Rampage. Number 5, the death of Sam Vasquez. Number 4, Mark Kerr. Number 3, Bob Sapp. Remember him? Number 2, the death of Pride. And number 1, Nevada legalizing this sport. Isn't that amazing?
Wow. Yeah.
And the UFC has now done 122 events in Las Vegas alone. They have done so much. And when they started this decade, January 1st, 2010, there were just 5 champions in the UFC. Lightweight champion BJ Penn, welterweight champion George St. Pierre, middleweight champion Anderson Silva, light heavyweight champion was Quentin Rampage Jackson, Lyoto Machida, and heavyweight champion was Brock Lesnar. Now there's 12 champions, and that's the perfect way to segue into our first defining story of the decade. In October of 2010, Dana White announced that the WEC would merge into the UFC in the coming months. They would bring over all the fighters from World Extreme Cage Fighting into the UFC, and with that they brought the featherweight champion Jose Aldo and the bantamweight champion Dominic Cruz. A lot of fans, I think, Mark, may not know what made WEC so special. Why was this such a big deal when they announced this move?
Well, one of the things is that it gave a platform to the lighter weight fighters who are some of the more popular and exciting fighters that we see here today. Uriah Faber was one of the faces of WEC, and he's fighting UFC 245 against Peter Yan. He's still a factor today, even after 40 years old. So it was a promotion that gave guys a chance that couldn't get into the UFC because they were too small, and now it almost seems very passe to think that.
Yeah, it really was. It was the legitimacy factor. I mean, anybody who was following the sport, covering it at that time, they knew that sometimes the WEC fights, those are the ones you really wanted to be at because the action was great. The fighting was just as high of a level as it was in the UFC, but a lot of fans, they didn't realize that because that was back still at the time. And I think we're still even dealing with this a little bit, so far less so now, where they're like, well, what's MMA? I just know UFC, you know? And meanwhile, high level MMA was taking place in the WEC, and it was less, fanfare. It was like you were standing next to world-class fighters and no one knew who they were. You know, it was almost kind of like, you know, when you have a great band and you recognize them and you find them before everybody else does and you go to a concert and you really get to appreciate them while no one else is there and then they end up blowing up. That's kind of what those WEC fights were. But it was great for the fighters once they went into the UFC because then all of a sudden they got all that attention that they really were deserving of because they were world-class athletes.
Anthony Pettis came from WEC. Yep. Donald Cowboy Cerrone is fighting Conor McGregor. He came from WEC. The list goes on. Benson Henderson. So many stars that ended up being very successful champions in the UFC came from WEC.
And it was interesting to watch those guys graduate to UFC because we all thought, I think the hardcore fan base thought that these guys are world class, right? Like Jose Aldo, Dominic Cruz, the names you just mentioned, they're world class, but maybe they weren't getting the recognition and attention that the UFC fighters were. So, you know, I remember the Jose Aldo belt ceremony prior to UFC 123 in Michigan, right? And I was like, wow, Jose Aldo is holding a UFC title. Mm-hmm. And remember that last WEC show in December of 2010 with the Showtime mm-hmm. kick? And we thought that he was going to get a title shot off of that. But of course, on January 1st, we had the draw between Edgar and Maynard. Yeah. But I thought it was really cool. Every time one of those guys finally debuted in the UFC, it was like, okay, it felt like a graduation. Like they went from college to mm-hmm. the big league, so to mm-hmm. speak. And it was cool to watch them. And a lot of people, I remember Jim Miller saying, oh, these guys are going to, you know, they're going to flame out. They can't hang in the UFC.
It's great.
Remember the story early was that they were all doing very well.
It was kind of like a UFC versus WEC little rivalry there in the beginning. And then Benson Henderson won a title. Donald Cerrone ends up fighting, you know, 5-6 times a year. And they really carved out a spot for themselves very, very quickly once those lightweights, you know, once they came into the UFC.
It's hard to imagine the UFC now if that never happened, if those guys never came over, if there was no WEC sending those guys.
And they didn't bring over the flyweight division, but essentially they helped open the door to the flyweight division as well. A couple of years later, Benavidez being a part of it, Demetrius Johnson being a part of it, Urshatani wasn't a part of it, Ian McCall, but like it bringing in the lighter guys, and that's essentially what it was, 155 down. I know they had 170 and 185, but it was really all about those lighter guys. Mm-hmm. That was a really big deal, and it was cool to see them all graduate. And more to that point, as the UFC continued to expand, I think the next big thing that happened was in March of 2011, and that was the Strikeforce purchase. Now, I don't want to speak for you guys, but I felt that this was an atomic bomb. This was a seismic shift. No one saw this coming. This wasn't something that was rumored, right? This wasn't something that we saw coming. It just kind of happened, and it changed the course of the sport forever, right?
Yeah, absolutely. When I look back on the UFC's acquisition of Strikeforce, I kind of look back on it as it was sort of like the last purchase where, you know, don't get me wrong, there are some other promotions out there that are doing some great things, but that was sort of the last one where they really had a strong roster and a strong fight library that would really, really benefit the UFC. And once the UFC took that over, it was kind of like, 'cause you know, they had purchased Pride. They had made these acquisitions before. And it sort of felt like they were kind of collecting these different promotions. And it felt like Strikeforce was the last one. You know, Strikeforce was definitely something that sat out there on its own. It was completely independent from the UFC and it didn't rival the UFC, but it was one of those ones that commanded your attention. It had certain athletes that absolutely commanded your attention. It had athletes that were ranked in the top five, top three of their respective weight classes. You know, there were conversations over, is Gilbert Melendez the best lightweight in the world? You know, that was sort of, to me, the end of those types of conversations, just because, well, now UFC has really sort of acquired, you know, just about everything that they would want to acquire.
You know, I would say once Pride was gone and there wasn't that competition between UFC and Pride, Strikeforce is really the best number two that there has been, even up until today. And look at all the fighters that went on to become UFC champions
so
and big stars. I mean, it's, again, talking about WEC, could you imagine a UFC without Daniel Cormier, Ronda Rousey, Luke Rockhold, Miesha Tate? The list goes on. We forget because it seems so long ago, but Strikeforce helped shape what UFC started to look like back then in 2011.
And also, they were actually gaining a lot of momentum. Remember when the UFC purchased, when Zuffa purchased Strikeforce, that was the beginning of the heavyweight Grand Prix. Mm-hmm. And that did really well on Showtime. The ratings were really good. And I actually remember seeing Scott Coker. We were in East Rutherford, New Jersey, first round of the heavyweight Grand Prix, and he was standing like off into the tunnel wearing a trench coat. He wasn't sitting cage side, and he was just kind of standing there and admiring the whole show. This is mid-show. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, it's weird that Scott Coker is standing there. Well, come to find out later, he knew this was coming to an end, and he was actually getting a little nostalgic about it all and watching it all kind of, he did not want to sell the company. It wasn't his decision. It was his partner's decision, the owners of the San Jose Sharks and HP Pavilion. This is something he didn't want and no one saw coming. Mm-hmm. And to your point, I would argue, yes, they brought over a lot of people. Nick Diaz, Alistair Overeem, you didn't mention. We'll get to the women in a second. But I'm still not convinced that was a good thing for the sport. It was a good thing for the fans, but I'm not convinced it was a good thing in the end for the fighters. Do you get what I'm saying?
Exactly. And that's kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, is that it felt like that was the real other legitimate show in town. And then once the UFC had purchased it, it was good from the sense, oh, hey, now we get to see Nick Diaz fight George St. Pierre. Now we get to see Gilbert Melendez take on lightweights in the UFC. You know, now we get to see all these guys who are in that heavyweight Grand Prix that was so exciting. They're going to come over. Cain Velasquez, Junior Dos Santos, we're going to have a much stronger heavyweight division. But at the same time, of course, you realize that, I mean, what Strikeforce did is something that I don't think, you know, Bellator has been able to do over the last few years. They built up homegrown talent. They had talent that was identifiable to Strikeforce, had no relationship whatsoever to the UFC, and it was talent that people wanted to watch. You know, now I think Bellator, you know, they're doing some good things over there, but as far as building up that homegrown talent, no one has been able to do it in a similar way that Strikeforce has at the time that they sold.
Like Brett said earlier, back then there were legitimate arguments, is the Strikeforce champion better than the UFC champion? That doesn't really exist as much today. There aren't as many arguments. There's a few here and there, but as a whole, it's really, the UFC has the top ranked fighters, but back then it was, is Luke Rockhold the best middleweight in the world? Is Gilbert Melendez the best 55er in the world?
As a consumer, it's better, because then you get to see everybody in the same place.
But for the fighters,
for the landscape of the division, of the sport, yes.
It's a great point about Bellator, because of course Scott Coker ended up becoming the president of Bellator. There was that weird period where he was working for Zuffa, and you could tell he didn't really want to do it, but it was part of the deal that he had to stick around, and towards the end you kind of just wanted it to go away, right? Like Showtime was no longer invested, and it just sort of fizzled out. But why do you guys think Bellator has been unable to recreate the magic of Strikeforce? It felt like Strikeforce was almost the little engine that could, and everyone almost rallied around it and was rooting for it. And Bellator, to me, feels like it still has the stench of the old era, where people felt like Bjorn wasn't a fighter-friendly promoter, and they didn't treat Eddie Alvarez, you remember that whole situation, and Rampage Jackson. For some reason, they don't seem like the darling that Strikeforce was. Why do you guys think that is?
I think part of it is that the UFC sucks all the air out of the room, and that's just something that Bellator can't do anything about. I think that that is just a challenge that they have to face that is just inevitable. It is what it is. You know, there's only so many people covering the sport. There's only so much time that people are willing to watch this sport, and the UFC, with their schedule and the way that they handle, conduct their business, it just sucks all the air out of the room. But beyond that, I think that Bellator has had a little bit of an identity crisis. You know, I don't, they put on these fights where we call them, you know, circus fights. There were a few of those. And I know that Scott Coker was not necessarily trying to build a business around them, but he was certainly willing to entertain them and willing to put them on. And at the same time, he is bringing in younger talent, but I don't think that Bellator does everything that it can to promote that young talent. You know, they have had guys like Michael Venom Page, and they had him for a long time before he really, I mean, you could have made an argument that up until a year or 2 years ago, Michael Venom Page had not really, his stock hadn't risen, even though he had been in Bellator for a while. They had Aaron Pico, and I think that they made some missteps in that one. They've got guys like Ed Ruth, you know, Tyrell Fortune, you know, those real strong amateur wrestlers who came over, and do you hear about those guys? Are you invested in their development as mixed martial artists? I mean, hardcores, sure, but I think that they have done fairly a poor job at getting those stories out and building that homegrown talent. Sometimes I feel like they go for just the easy grab. And in this sport, you know, with the king that the UFC is and all the attention that they have, I just don't think that's going to be enough.
To piggyback a bit on what Brett said earlier, I think at the time that Strikeforce was thriving, there were so much fewer UFC events, and therefore there were fewer UFC fighters. So there were a lot more fighters that were available. There was a bigger pool that Strikeforce could pluck from, whereas that pool has narrowed significantly over the last decade or so.
Yeah, and I miss Strikeforce. I just want to say that. I really do, because Strikeforce, the events always felt special. To your point, they didn't do as many as Bellator does or the UFC does. It always just, and sometimes they were criticized for too many mismatches, or, you know, there was that one card back in St. Louis where everything ended in a knockout and Lin got knocked out. And I was like, geez, Louise, it was like CTE Strikeforce. But I don't know, there was just something different. And they did feel like the little Bay Area promotion had grown up, and they were able to, you know, build homegrown talent. I remember going to an event back in the day where Babalu Sobral fought Bobby Southworth in the main event. It was an HDNet Fights card. And then when the card was over, the telecast was over, they brought up these two local guys who were 1-0 going up against an 0-1 fighter. Their only fights were against each other previously, and they were huge Bay Area draws. I'd never heard of them. The place exploded, and I was like, wow, this is the brilliance of Strikeforce right here. Mm-hmm. They figured out how to sell for the local crowd, but also for the television crowd as well.
All right, let's take a quick time out on this discussion. I'm enjoying it very much, but I want to tell you guys about the 2019 Professional Fighters League season finale. It goes down on December 31st, New Year's Eve, and it concludes with six world title fights at their biggest event of the year. The PFL Championship, New Year's Eve, New York City, Madison Square Garden, the world's most famous arena, six $1 million belts on the line. Who will be the six PFL champions crowned? It'll be a rematch in the main event between Kayla Harrison and Larissa Pacheco, with $1 million and the world championship on the line. Fighters on the card are looking to build legacies, and we are all looking for a knockout way to end the year. The ball doesn't drop until the PFL belts are raised. Don't miss the biggest night in MMA. The action starts at 7 p.m. Eastern, and you can watch it only on ESPN2. All right, now back to the roundtable.
Now, the next milestone came just a few months later, August of 2011, when the UFC announced their television deal with Fox. Remember that press conference that they had on the lot? How awkward that was with Joe Rogan reading the teleprompter?
The wrong names. Yes, in the wrong order.
I think it was like Rashad and GSP.
Was
were
he wearing
confused.
A jacket or something? Everybody was up in arms that, my God, they made Joe Rogan wear a jacket on camera.
That's it. The UFC's Fox is ruining the UFC. Joe Rogan's wearing a jacket.
But 2 seconds in, everybody hated it.
It was a weird start. But it did feel like a graduation of sorts for the company, right? To go from Spike TV cable TV only to broadcast network television, right?
Oh, 100%, because Spike TV was, it's a big cable network, but there's Spike TV and then there's Fox. It's right. A different level that's much more prominent, much more well known. It made the UFC seem like a bigger deal than what it was. It wasn't just on, you know, a men's network on cable. It was on Fox. It was on one of the big networks, one of the big channels.
It's hard to remember this because, you know, it was 10 years ago, but I mean, all of us do. How hard this sport worked to get attention and how hard it worked to convince people that this is not just some bloody cage barbaric thing. You know, I mean, that was a fight that they had for a long time. And so I remember when they went to Fox and then you saw on a Fox NFL Sunday, you saw a promo for the UFC and you heard, you know, your traditional sportscasters, these older guys who had been in football forever, you know, they're talking about Benson Henderson's going to fight Nate Diaz. I mean, that was a cool time in the sport. Yeah. I mean, obviously it was a big deal to just widen the net and have more people, more eyeballs on the sport. But it was also just, for a sport that fought so hard to be legitimate, to be recognized by some of those names, even though you knew that they had to say it, they were being told to say it, to hear it from them, it just felt like a big stepping stone for all of those people who had been there from, you know, the beginning.
Yeah, and Fox essentially used the UFC to help launch FS1, right? And for a while they helped stabilize Fuel TV. Remember Fuel TV? Mm-hmm. The late grade Fuel TV. But remember that first event back in November of 2011? Mm-hmm. What a disaster that was. Remember the panel? there was John Jones, Brock Lesnar, right?
Yeah.
Dana came in as a panel. Like, he was like an actual analyst on the desk as well. And then none of the fights leading up to the main event were on television. They were all on Facebook. Clay Guida going up against Benson Henderson.
Biggest mistake
Facebook.
Ever.
And it was an amazing
fight.
When
we look back on that, that was the biggest misstep, right? Should have had Clay Guida and Benson Henderson on TV because it turned out to be an amazing fight.
Yeah, and then, of course, the main event came last
one fight place. Card, right?
Yeah, knocked down in 61 seconds.
Yeah.
And then they had to go back to like Brock and John Jones. I remember like John was like moving around in his chair. He didn't know what to do. But it was just, what was fun about it was like this brave new world, right? Like, what is it going to look like? That first show on network television, that felt like a really big deal. And then we move along almost a year later. Finally, they decide to bring the women over. Mm-hmm. And you guys remember, speaking of Benson Henderson versus Nate Diaz, do you remember the press conference in Seattle?
That's right.
And all of a sudden, Ronda Rousey is named champion at the press conference. Remember Nate like looking up at her and being like, good job.
I remember that press conference for two reasons. That, and then also, when the cameras caught Ben Henderson fighting with a toothpick in his mouth, and then it was asked to Nate Diaz, he might have had a toothpick in his mouth. What do you think of that? And he said, that's weird.
Yeah. But that was such an interesting way to debut her, right? Like, it felt like it was a very small press conference. There weren't that many people there, but who would have thought that would have, you know, that moment turns into a moment that changes the
I'm
face
trying
of the
to remember.
Forever.
Didn't they mention that she had been signed prior to that? Like, I think that she got the belt and she became a champion there.
Correct.
But I'm remembering that she was actually here in Vegas and they took her to Nellis Air Force Base and she flew around in an airplane. And then when she came down, she gave an interview about how she had signed to be a UFC fighter.
Yeah. But we weren't sure if she was going to be champion right off the bat because she was the Strikeforce 135-pound champion.
Yep.
Do you remember that press conference?
I do. Yes, of course.
It was an interesting way to start. And then we get to UFC 157, mm-hmm. and that's the first ever female fight in UFC history. And it's kind of interesting that we talk about it now with Liz Carmouche recently getting released. UFC 157, February of 2013, Anaheim, California. What do you recall from that historic event?
It was, first of all, leading to the event, there was a little bit of controversy that Rousey versus Carmouche was going to headline over Lyoto Machida versus Dan Henderson.
Right. Yes.
And people were saying, well, these are two former MMA champions. These are much bigger names. And in hindsight, it kind of seems ridiculous, right? That we're talking about as great as those guys are handling over Ronda Rousey, who's one of the biggest stars in history.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some pushback there. even among the hardcore fans. And it ended up being a great fight. And man, what a difference history could have made if Carmouche had won that fight. If she was on Ronda Rousey's back, she had, you know, almost had the choke in. It was a great fight. And it was the kind of fight that I think also hooked people in and said, you know, this is going to work out. These are the kind of fights that we want to see. And it ended up working out. The right winner won in this case for what the UFC wanted to do. And it went on from there.
Man, I just remember the women stepping up to the plate because I'll be honest, when they first made the announcement, I wasn't a huge fan of it. And it's not because I was against women's fighting at all. I just wasn't sure if it was deep enough. You know, it's why I was against, you know, them introducing a 145-pound female championship just 2 years ago. I just wasn't sure if the talent level was going to be enough that you could put on a consistent amount of fights and have them be UFC caliber. You know, I thought the worst thing that could happen is if they try to just fill these divisions with anybody that they can find, and then all of a sudden you have this very low quality of fighting taking place in the octagon. And that's not to say that there weren't good female fighters, but I just didn't know how many there were. And I remember that weekend in Anaheim, they had a media dinner. And they brought in, I'm sure you guys remember this. You were there. Kat Zingano.
Mm-hmm. Misha Tate.
Who else was there? Misha Tate. I feel like there were four of them. And looking back on that, man, how much pressure was on those women to come in and not only, you know, it's hard enough to just compete in this tough sport, but then to also prove that, hey, we are as skilled as the men. We are worth your money, worth your time and your attention. I mean, it's not that women's MMA just was like, did not exist. People were aware of it, but to go into the octagon, I mean, that was a lot of pressure to put on a small, I think, amount of women that they had to perform. And then I think shortly after that, Kat Zingano and Misha Tate fought, and it was absolutely outstanding fight at the Ultimate Fighter finale. Those women came through at a time when the sport really needed them.
Yeah, because they weren't on every single card. They were sprinkled throughout. But every time they fought, it felt like a special thing.
Yeah, it did.
A big deal. And to your point, they always delivered.
They performed.
Do you remember that Carmouche, actually, as her opponent, was sort of an underwhelming choice initially? People wanted it to be Cyborg versus Ronda, if you recall, and they were like, oh, Carmouche wasn't really a title contender in Strikeforce, but she ended up being the perfect foil. She had a great backstory and almost won the fight. Do you think if Carmouche wins that fight that they just get rid of the division?
Wow. That's a tough one. I think no. I don't think they just get rid of the division because
look how Ronda reacted when she eventually lost.
What if
she would have lost that night?
But that was years later after a very,
I'm just
very
saying, what
long
if she would have lost
up?
that night and never came back? Are they as invested in women's MMA?
Could they have turned around and just made the rematch right away and just been like, the woman that we wanted to win didn't win? I mean,
I don't even know if she comes back. I'm just saying. Yeah. I'm just throwing it out there.
Misha Tate, Liz Carmouche, Tate wins, you do the Rousey Tate rematch. There's a lot of things I could
say. You don't think so?
No, I don't think they just abandoned it right then and there. No.
I don't think so either, but it's a fair question.
Sure. And you remember for a while we were like, okay, is it just the Rousey division? And then I think Joanna helped calm people down that, look, another person could be the face of another weight class, right?
Yeah.
And then eventually they had 125. 145 is still in a bit of a weird spot right now. But I think this decision has paid off, right?
Man, I'll give it to Dana White, too. You mentioned Joanna. I remember her UFC debut. I believe it was in Phoenix.
It was in San Jose.
Yeah.
On a Fox card. And Jake Fox.
And she won.
Yeah.
But I didn't see anything there that suggested to me that Joanna Jędrzejczyk was going to be a star. Do you remember Dana White invited her to come out and sit next to him?
All over his Instagram that night. He saw it right away.
He saw it.
Right away.
I got to give him credit for that because I didn't think, you know, watching her debut, like, oh, this is someone who's going to now really carry a torch for women's MMA. He saw it immediately.
Yeah, she beat Juliana Lima. And it was like, I think it might have been the first fight on the card. It's an okay fight. It wasn't a finish.
Right.
But, yeah, Dana saw something in Joanna right away.
Along with the signing of the Fox deal came this massive global expansion of the UFC where they started to show up all over the world. It wasn't just for a very long time they weren't in Canada even, right? And then they weren't in Ontario, and that was a big deal that happened at the beginning of the decade. But then they started to go all over Europe, and then, of course, they went back to Asia. Brazil was a huge deal when they finally came back there. I remember UFC 134 was such a huge deal. I remember Lorenzo Fertitta telling us, like, oh, yeah, we're going to come here, like, 4 or 5 times a year. And I was like, what, 4 or 5 times a year? They ended up coming, you know, 4 or 5 times a year for the longest time. Did you guys think, though, like, when you look back, do you think that they expanded a little too quickly? You know, there's something to be said for oversaturation, right? Or do you think looking back, no, this was brilliant. This is what they had to do. Get these TV deals all over the world. Get these fighters from all over the world, these shows from all over the world. How do you guys look back at this? Because, I mean, think back to 2009. They were not doing shows all over the world like they are now or did in the early days. How do you guys feel about how quickly it all happened in the beginning of that decade?
I mean, I feel like it's worked out fairly well. Mm-hmm. I mean, the proof is in the pudding because not only, I mean, a lot of those early shows did fairly well. And then when they continue to go back to those markets, it doesn't do as well. But that's just the natural evolution of things. But I think more so when they went to those markets, it also caught the notice of the local fighters there. And now the roster is such an international roster where there are European champions. There are champions now from the Australia, New Zealand area. There are champions. We have a Chinese champion in the UFC. So I think that all of that global expansion, that big push right away, has paid dividends now years later.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I remember what that felt like during those years, you know, from I mean, I got into the sport in 2009 and it felt like, you know, 2010 through 2013, 14, it felt like, you know, these days we just go to a city, we set up, you know, it's the same kind of thing every time. And during those years, it felt like there was this education process. And it also felt like there was this big, excitement level. Oh my gosh, the UFC right. has come to our city, you know, and they really played off that. They did some local type things, you know, you always saw fighters coming out in local teams apparel. And it just felt like that expansion part was very obvious. It's like, we are growing this sport, you know, and when they went out there, part of the PR's, responsibilities were to go and get those local newspapers mm-hmm. writing about it. So I think in a way it helped educate more fans, and I don't think it hurt the product domestically. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people watching this discussion will remember some times where they're like, man, there's just too many cards. It's oversaturated. It's too thin. But when you look at it now, did it ever really hurt the product? I mean, mm-hmm. when you look at where it's led to right now, no, I think their global expansion, I mean, there's been a few hit and misses, and there have been some places that they wanted to get in that they have failed. But by and large, I think that their expansion has been pretty successful.
In February of 2013, UFC signed a Cage Warriors double champion. And in April of 2013, in Stockholm, Sweden, that double champion debuted. His name...
can't think of it. His name, should we Google it?
Yeah. His name, Conor McGregor. And he debuted against Marcus Brimage. And, of course, we don't have to introduce him or tell you too much about him. Everyone knows the Conor McGregor story. But what I'm wondering is, when did you guys first kind of realize, when did you believe that Conor would become a megastar? I remember I used to do a show called The MMA Beat, and Jeff Wagenheim of ESPN now, and I would argue a lot about Conor, and he would always say, oh, I'm not a believer, he's all hype, he's all talk. And I was like, at some point, are you ever going to just believe that this guy's worthy of all this hype? Like, he yeah. is beating everyone, short notice, whatever. When did you guys start to believe that he was actually worthy of all this hype and that he would turn into a superstar? Maybe not the biggest star ever, but a superstar.
I know the exact moment.
Okay.
The exact moment. I'll never forget it. UFC 178, mm-hmm. as long as I'm getting the number right, I'm yeah. kind of... UFC 178, Dustin yeah. Poirier. Yeah. They held the weigh-in. A lot of times they do the weigh-in at the arena. They didn't hold it at the arena. They held it in this big conference room at MGM. You know, mm-hmm. just that really, really yeah. wide, wide conference room. And he wasn't even the main event. And when he got up there, it was nuts. It was like Wednesday was dead. Thursday was kind of dead. Friday, all of a sudden, Ireland showed up. And it was just Ireland in this giant, giant conference room. And when he got on the scale... And I remember, like, one thing about even Conor, maybe this is just something I noticed, but he always used to change his hair mm-hmm. between every single fight. Yeah. That was the man bun look yeah. for 178.
The shaved sides.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the Irish fans loved it. And yeah. they were going crazy for him. And I remember standing there during the weigh-in, and I was like, this is different, man. This has a different feeling to it. I mean, I was fortunate enough to see some with, like, Ricky Hatton in the boxing world, and that was the closest thing that I could compare it to. And then when he won at UFC 178, it was like that again. And I was like, at that moment, he had knocked out Dustin Poirier, who was a very good fighter. He knocked him out convincingly, very, very quickly. And I said, this guy is something completely different. He just, you can't even compare him to any fighter in the sport right now.
I would say the first time that I really thought that was one fight before against Diego Brandão in Ireland because of I think maybe still best crowd in UFC history. I think you could say, you can make that argument certainly. Mm-hmm. Just the way that they gave him the hero's welcome. And yeah, it's a different country, but there are very few fighters who kind of capture that anywhere, their mm-hmm. own country, United States, wherever it may be. And he did. And it was a different level that night. And then he went on there and then it really hit home some of these Vegas shows where, like Brett said, thousands of Irish people just descend on the city and they're filling up the MGM Grand Casino and they're chanting and they're dancing, and it's like a different atmosphere than any other fight week when Conor McGregor fights, and that still continues.
It was so special. I remember the Brimage knockout and Kenny Florian's working as an analyst. This is why everyone's so excited about this guy. I remember just how good he looked in that fight. And they come back. He's supposed to fight Andy Ogle in Boston. Ogle drops out and it's Max Holloway. And they give him the championship walkout on television, like from the actual, he was on the prelims and he's walking out from the locker room to the cage, tears his ACL, disappears for 11 months. But he did this thing where like he never stayed out of the news. Remember, he was like just calling everyone out and poking at everyone, stayed in the news. He was going to fight Cole Miller,
yes,
in Ireland. He pulls out. Diego Brandão. It's maybe the greatest experience of my career being in Dublin for that. I will never forget that crowd and even the build up. The young kids talking about how much they loved him and looked up to him. And then when he beats Brandão and he says, "We're not here to take part. We're here to take over." Like then it all changes in my opinion. And then of course it's the Poirier fight and then we just go on like a rocket. I mean, then it's Dennis Seaver and on, I mean, him in Boston, back in Boston. Now he's the main event. That's a huge deal. Jumps over the cage, right? And confronts Aldo. And then of course the Aldo situation.
The world tour.
Yes.
In Rio is throwing darts at.
But the fight doesn't, happen, doesn't happen. And the Mendes thing happened, which also like in a way kind of like made him an even bigger star because he took the fight on short notice. And then of course the 13 second knockout, it was just amazing to watch. That was such a special time. It was so much fun, right?
Oh, it was such a special time.
So much fun to cover that
and,
period.
And you know, we got to thank the Irish fans, I think, a lot for that because them coming to Vegas, it was just, it turned a fight week into something that you can't replicate it. I mean, I don't feel it anymore. I mean, you get some big fights, you get some big fight feels, but there's nothing like an entire, you know, group of Irishmen coming over to cheer on one guy, you know, and especially as he was still ascending and trying to get to that one perfect pinnacle at the top that was Jose Aldo. I mean, you couldn't have written that any better.
I have clothes that still smell like beer from those
events. Oh, nice. Yes.
You haven't washed clothes that smell like beer as well.
I don't know if it's from the event. Commemoration.
Speaking of clothes, December of 2014, the UFC announced its deal with Reebok.
And, an excellent segue, Aaron.
Thank you. The kit, if you will, and the introduction of this deal had all kinds of mess ups, right? You know, the names were misspelled. It seemed like one big fumble. And we're still in the Reebok era, so to speak. We'll see very soon if they re-up with them. I think this is one of the biggest mistakes in UFC history to sign a deal. You've taken away the individuality of the fighters, what makes the fight game so much fun. Being different characters, Tito Ortiz was different, Chuck Liddell was different, Mike Tyson was different. I understand why they did it. I, as a fan, did not like that they did it. How do you guys feel about the deal all these years later?
I would say initially, definitely feel the same way, and it's gotten better than what it was back then, but for several reasons, including the individuality, there's also a financial issue, right? Because fighters used to get paid for the sponsors they wore on their shirt, their shorts, or their walkout shirts, or whatever. And that all went away. And they got a fee from Reebok that was, for many fighters, especially ones who were more popular, paled in comparison to what they used to make from their own sponsors. So that hurt them in the wallet right away, fighters. And as far as individuality, that was one of the things that built the sport, I felt. Chuck Liddell, everyone knew Chuck Liddell because he wore the icicles on his shorts. And, you know, Anderson Silva had the yellow trunks, you know, it just identifying factors. So it wasn't, I feel like it's gotten better and they've made improvements over the years in Reebok and it's been a while now, but initially it was a bit of a disaster.
As far as this overall impact on the sport, I have to say that I think it's been positive. And I say that because I understand, you know, this is the world we live in. This is the world how it works. When I am looking back on some of those older fights and you see some of those, it can be jarring. You forget just how bad and tacky some of it looked. And I know that you're saying that it allowed expressism. I think what needs to happen, what still needs to happen, is they need to find a system in which you can have a uniform that corporate people can get behind. You know, because I can tell you right now that I think ESPN probably prefers the Reebok look over, you know, some of the things that they used to see inside the octagon. I know sponsors, you know, big time sponsors, not just the smaller sponsors, but the big time sponsors that you hope get involved in the sport because they're worth more money. They appreciate that look more than what they used to have. But I think it was just too restrictive. You know, I remember that when it first came out, it was just like, not only do you have to wear a fight kit, but it has to be worn, you know, during the week, during press conferences. Mm-hmm. I mean, you are removing all pieces of individualism from them at that point. I mean, we kind of celebrate when someone's able to wear, you know, a headdress, you know, an Indian headdress because she's a Native American. Those aren't things that we should be like, oh, yay, Reebok allowed this to happen. You know, there has to be certain freedoms and flexibilities within this. But I think overall, if you're asking just black and white, is it better to have no uniform or let these guys wear, you know, whatever they want? I mean, I think it's better for the sport if it has a uniform look.
I'm definitely glad that the Affliction tap out shirt era is over. All respect to those.
I personally miss it.
You missed the Affliction shirts. Look, I mean, I think that era and that style is gone and dead. But I think there is also a happy medium between the Reebok now and some of those very, very ugly designs from back then.
Well, you're a fashionable guy,
but I know you wouldn't be wearing an Affliction shirt.
Mark, you had some rhinestones and skulls.
There's top rank boxing. You see the guys wearing whatever they want. I don't know if I buy that, you know, a network would prefer that. I understand they were trying to package it, maybe to eventually sell it. They wanted it to look like a mainstream sport. But the analogy always was, oh, football players all have to wear the same thing, or basketball players, well, they get to sell, you know, their shoe rights and their glove rights. So you were taking a lot away from the fighters. And around the same time, in fact, in June of 2015, they signed the USADA deal. And, I mean, I feel like we could do a 45-minute show on just those two topics themselves. You are the USADA expert. How would you categorize the way that deal has gone over the past 5 years?
There, I mean, like the Reebok deal, there's been some starts and stops with USADA, right? But I think ultimately it's been a positive for the sport overall. I mean, I think there was a perception before USADA that this was a sport rife with performance-enhancing drugs. Everyone was using steroids. I mean, some of the physiques wouldn't bear that out, that a lot of people were using some kind of PED. And USADA did come in and clean it up, and it wasn't always smooth, and there have been a lot of arguments and discussions. But I do feel like, at the end of the day, it has helped the sport. Because, look, if you just want to look at it plainly, there are fewer fighters on the roster in the UFC right now on any kind of PED, any kind of banned substance than there were in 2014 or 2013. I think that's pretty safe to say, right?
Yeah, and I agree. And I don't think I have much more to add on Mark's. I mean, I think overall, if you just ask a simple question, you know, has the sport been cleaned up in terms of performance-enhancing drug use? I would say that the answer is yes. Now, have there been a lot of different cases where people are kind of learning about things as they come along? I mean, we've had some of these weird cases, some of these very specific cases, and it's a constantly evolving thing. It's not just something that, hey, we made this policy in 2015, we're good, you know, as we're seeing, especially over the last couple years, that they've had to make some changes to it, and they have to acknowledge some different things that are happening in the science of this stuff. You know, these are two completely separate deals, the USADA deal and the Reebok deal. But one thing I think they have in common, and I think both of you guys will agree with me on, is that the fighters didn't get really, really get a say in it. And that's kind of the big issue here, right? I mean, you can feel like, I like the individualism of the shorts, you know, and I can say, I can see how a broadcast network would be more in favor of having a uniform. That's fine. You know, we can have those kinds of discussions, but at the end of the day, the fighters never had a say. The fighters never got a say in how the money was broken up. The fighters never got a say in how much money they got from it. And USADA, they never got a say over what they were comfortable with them testing for, or when they were testing, or all these little things about it. And that continues to be an issue in this sport, is just the lack of input that the fighters have in some of these things.
Yep, that's a great point, and it's very well said. Very few fighters were affected by the USADA deal, more so than John Jones, right, on multiple occasions. And one wonders, as he continues to not lose, right, he has that one blemish, but no one really considers it a true loss against Matt Hamill at the very beginning of the decade. He's about to fight again in February. Will this always be a black cloud? Or let's say he goes on and fights for another 8 years. Is there a point where the lead of his story isn't, you know, all the PED stuff, the USADA stuff, or will this always follow him forever?
I think it will always follow him to an extent, but anyone who's following the sport closely understands that there is a lot of gray area in some of these failed drug tests, right? There's a lot of nuance. It doesn't mean this guy is on steroids, this female fighter is on steroids. There's a lot more to it than that. And in both cases, John Jones was cleared of intentional wrongdoing by USADA. Now, that may not make its way over to the mainstream fans who only see the drug test, but people who follow the sport do understand that there's always going to be kind of a cloud of suspicion against him. And yeah, I mean, he did test positive on two separate occasions. And in the most recent one, he was testing positive for a very small amount of a steroid metabolite for over a year. So it's one of those things where USADA went from 0 to 100 very quickly when they started with the UFC. And there were some fighters who kind of got caught up in that. And I think John Jones was one of them. But personally, I still think he's the greatest fighter of all time, to fail drug tests or not.
Okay, I was going to ask you that. Good to know. What about the year, or I should say the decade, John Jones had? Because even if you put aside the USADA stuff, still remember the Bentley incident, remember the hit-and-run incident. There's been a lot of other stuff in addition to all the USADA controversies as well. But yet, still, in many people's eyes, the GOAT, and still undefeated in many people's eyes. What a complex character this decade, right?
But I'll say this. There have been times over the last 10 years that I really thought, John Jones ain't coming back from this one.
Yeah.
John Jones ain't going to get out of this one. And look at him. Look at him now, 2019. You know, he said he was going to do this. He came into the year saying, I'm going to stay active. I'm going to win fights. I'm going to, you know, put all that in the past. And for the most part, he has. I mean, he puts out something on Twitter, and there's a lot of people saying picogram this and picogram that, you know, and I think the cocaine thing will always follow him around. But by and large, you asked the question earlier, 8 years from now, will we talk? I don't think we will. I don't think people will bring this up. As long as he continues to win, that's what people care about. And I think that there will be some people say, hey, you know, remember that he had that issue with the drug test. But I don't think people are going to remember that he was pulled from a big UFC International Fight Week fight against Daniel Cormier. I think that's going to slip their mind, and they're going to remember the time that he choked out Leona Machida. They're going to remember the time that he knocked out Daniel Cormier, even though that turned into a no contest. I think those are the things that they're going to remember about John Jones.
For all of John Jones' great skills, his greatest attribute is his ability to bounce back and make people forget about what happened in the past.
And one of his lowest moments came at UFC 200. It was supposed to be, you know, the big fight against Daniel Cormier. We find out just days before the event that he has to, you know, withdraw from the event because of the failed drug test. He's up there crying. Remember that? DC is crying. They call Anderson Silva. This is supposed to be a big, you know, culmination event for the UFC, a milestone event. But 2016, despite that, despite the debacle that 200 turned into with Brock Lesnar as well afterwards, 2016, in my opinion, the greatest year in the history of this sport. Five pay-per-views, million plus.
Oh, yeah.
New York finally legalizes mixed martial arts in March of 2016, the milestone event. And then, of course, the sale in July of 2016, literally hours after UFC 200. I want to know, because this happened like late at night, right? Where were you guys? You were on the West Coast. I don't know if you were on the West Coast yet. Were you? Where were you guys when you found out about the sale of the UFC?
Well, I mean, I think we had all heard, you know, rumors that it was potential.
Yeah.
But when I found out that, hey, this is happening, I was at Topgolf. I was at Topgolf, knocking them in, you know, scoring personal highs at Topgolf in Las Vegas.
It. Yep. Unbelievable. How about you?
It was the day after UFC 200.
Yep.
I was in a minivan driving from Las Vegas to my home in Los Angeles with other media members, and it came out on social media, and I'm driving a car. Mm-hmm. And my first instinct is to, oh, I gotta pull over.
Yeah.
I know I'm, you know, I'm in the middle of the desert, but I gotta pull over and write a story or at least do some reaction on one of the biggest stories in UFC history.
Yeah.
I didn't do that. I continued driving, but
that
was my first instinct.
I have a weird thing where, like, I always wake up at 2-3 a.m. in the middle of the night because I'm neurotic, and I check my phone to see if I've missed anything. And I woke up to a bunch of texts saying the UFC, because it would happen like at 11 p.m. or something, West Coast
happened
time. And I think Lorenzo Fertitta did an interview on local television, right?
Yep.
And woke up to that, and I was like, oh my God, the entire sport has changed forever.
And then you set the phone back down and went back to bed?
It was hard. It was hard to go back to bed. I got to be honest.
The 2019 Professional Fighters League season concludes with 6 world title fights at the biggest event of the year. The PFL Championship, New Year's Eve, New York City, Madison Square Garden, 6 $1 million belts on the line. Who will be the 6 PFL champions crowned? It'll be a rematch between Kayla Harrison and Larissa Pacheco with $1 million and the 155-pound female championship on the line. Fighters are looking to build legacies, and I'm looking for a knockout victory. The ball doesn't drop until the PFL belts are raised. Don't miss one of the biggest nights in MMA. The action starts at 7 p.m. Eastern, and you can watch it only on ESPN2.
So we get to the sale. The sale comes and goes. Conor McGregor fights Nate Diaz shortly thereafter. Then he debuts in New York. So much is going on. Free agency. Everyone's talking about the money fight. Everyone's talking about, I want to get paid more. I want to get this and that. And then we get to Mayweather-McGregor, which almost changes everything, right? Who would have thought an MMA fighter can actually fight a boxer, especially that MMA fighter and that boxer? How has Mayweather-McGregor aged 3 years later? Do you look at it the same way that you looked at it the night of the fight?
It almost seems like it didn't happen.
It does seem like that occasionally, yeah.
It just seems like a blip on the radar, and then it went away, and it was a really big thing for that one summer in 2017. But I feel like since then, it's almost like, I mean, there have been MMA fighters and boxers calling each other out more often, but other than that,
for me, it's the same. For me, it's the same. I can distinctly remember a conversation I had on Mike and Mike, and I made one point, and I said, this is fun. This is all in good, you know, we're having a great time. Conor McGregor's going to make a lot of money. Everybody's happy. However, this is an example of casual fans maybe kind of ruining something that the hardcore fans have, because Conor McGregor is a special individual. But if he goes out and fights Floyd Mayweather and loses, as we all know he's going to, and he makes $100 million, he's probably going to lose some motivation that would turn him into something that I want to see if he can turn into. You know, Conor McGregor at that time was somebody that I looked at as, this guy could be the greatest of all time. We don't know. I mean, he's on that path. But taking this divergence to Floyd Mayweather, which I get, and good for him, but it's going to take him off of it. And I think very clearly we've seen over the last 3 years that it did take him off of that. So I look back on it as, hey, good for him making that money, but it does sadden me as a mixed martial arts fan, because I would have loved to know what would have happened to Conor McGregor had he never taken that fight.
Yeah, and of course, he ends up returning to fight Khabib, but that was, you know, one of the craziest stretch. I mean, that event in Brooklyn, right? The UFC 223 event, those 48 hours with the Dolly incident and the
so much spectacle.
The court appearance, and it was just like, what is going on? In addition to the event itself with Max Holloway pulling out, right? He was replacing Tony Ferguson. That was just the craziest week ever. And it ended up being another one of those events where it's like, you're going through it and it's crazy. But then you look back on it and it's like, and the brawl afterwards, there's weird feelings towards it, right? Like, I don't even think the fans are ready to accept these guys fighting again because of how tense and how, you know, toxic that feud was, right?
With Khabib and McGregor, it went to uncomfortable territory that I think we can all agree that fight promotion, and at least in MMA, hasn't really gone to with religion and culture being brought into it, and the fans kind of being run into that kicking and screaming and real violence. I mean, real, like, outside the cage violence, where Conor McGregor's picking up a dolly and throwing it through a bus window. Michael Chiesa gets injured in that. Ray Borg gets injured. They had to pull out of their fights a few days later. It felt like MMA is supposed to be fun. It's a sport, something that people do kind of in their free time. It's a hobby. And then it got very real when that whole thing was going on. It got visceral, and that was kind of uncomfortable.
Well, it got to a point where it just felt like, man, I want to watch these two fight because they're at the top of their game and they're best. And now I feel like we're watching this fight because they can put on the best show. You know, and that's why, like, if you talk about a rematch, I mean, to your point, maybe the fans aren't ready for it yet because it doesn't feel like it's the two best guys right now. Like, let's get those guys at the top of their games. Let's have the two best guys fight. If the show comes along with it, cool. But I don't want the show to come along before what we should expect inside the octagon.
So much that we could talk about as far as this entire decade is concerned. I think we all agree that it has been an unbelievable decade as far as covering the sport.
Yeah.
So many stories each and every year, each and every month. At times it felt dizzying, right? But the sport has come such a long way. It has evolved to such a great degree. And there's even a few things that we skipped over, like the return of GSP. What a great scene that was, and the events at Madison Square Garden. But for now, we are out of time. And of course, how could we forget the deal with ESPN, which perhaps changed the landscape of the sport forever. But again, for now, we are out of time. We want to thank you all for watching our coverage and reading our coverage and listening to our coverage, not only here at ESPN, but all over for MMA media, because we have all come a long way. We weren't even at ESPN not that long ago. So we've come a long way, and we are all looking forward to what the next decade is going to bring as far as the sport of mixed martial arts is concerned. Again, for now, we're out of time. Happy holidays, season greetings, happy new year for Mark, for Brett, for our entire crew. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next decade.